Hi, everybody. Welcome to our end of the year CLE program. My name is Jim Wolverton, and I'm the Director of Legal Education. This program is called New Year, New Practice Area, Medicaid Planning. Just a little bit of information about me. My career has been in elder law for the last 10 years. I did the math, and it's actually been a full 10 years now that I've been working with attorneys that are interested in adding elder law to their practices. I started with elder counsel 10 years ago, and there in that job, my job was to work hands-on with attorneys that were looking to onboard into elder law from other different practice areas. And we're investigating the practice area to see if it was a good one for them. And then as I worked through that group, I ended up as a director of education there, and in April or May transferred over here at Kraus Financial to the director of legal education role. But one thing I've always enjoyed doing is at the end of the year, talk to attorneys about their goals for the next year. And through the years of working with attorneys, I know kind of at the end of the year, you're looking at your numbers. You're looking at your calendar. You're wondering, hey, could I add a new practice area that allows me to get more of my time back where I can make the same or more money? And elder law, Medicaid planning always tends to be one of those practice areas, especially for estate planning attorneys, that is very attractive for the next year. So, what I want to do with this particular program, and it's something that I've done, like I said, yearly, probably for the last 5 years now, is just talk about what is Medicaid planning, what does that look like, to give you all a brief overview of what that would look like. So if you're planning to move into Medicaid planning in the next year, you have 2 weeks to put together a plan, obviously put a marketing plan together, put a financial plan together, figure out what that's going to look like in the next year. But on this particular webinar, I want to give you a really high-level overview of what Medicaid planning is and why it's so important. So that's kind of where this program came from and why I like doing it at the end of the year each year. So let's a quick overview about Kraus Financial. For those of you that don't know, we are an attorney-led firm that provides asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys and their clients. We use specialized insurance products, resources, and support, and we help attorneys streamline the process of advising clients planning for long-term care. And like I said, I've been doing this for 10 years. Kraus Financial has been in business for 30, so they've been doing it for 20 years before I even started in elder law. We have 40 plus professionals on staff. We are a growing business. Again, I'm one of those newer attorneys to the firm. And then just so you know, and we'll talk a little bit about what Medicaid compliant annuities are, but we average about 400 of those cases each and every month. So we are working hand in hand with local attorneys in most communities to help their clients get their clients qualified for Medicaid benefits as quickly and efficiently as possible. So just I always like to start to kind of give a roadmap of where we're going. On today's goals, what I want to do, and there's even a 0.5 here on today's goals, is talk a little bit about why long-term care planning is so important and run some numbers past you. And then we'll get into the basic requirements of the Medicaid program and defining those, and then explore a little bit about crisis planning, what that looks like, what that means, and then discuss a little bit about proactive Medicaid planning as well. Most attorneys usually start in one or the other of those and then expand into the other as they get more comfortable with those practice areas. But I do want to just slow down for one step and talk about why this is so important. And the reason why I want to communicate this to you all is because these are numbers that you can share with the professionals in your community when you're putting together presentations and seminars and webinars to educate your community. These are the stats that people need to know, and not a lot of people know about them. I'll refer to a New York Times article that came out in November that really emphasized a lot of these issues that we'll be talking about today. So it is getting more into the mainstream conversation of things, but it's still, I think, really not addressed. And we'll talk about some numbers that kind of point to this, where families aren't really discussing this over the kitchen table. They're not making this part of their estate plans, and they need to be. And these are some of the numbers that you can share with those in your communities that need this type of help or may not understand why the type of planning you can do with Medicaid planning or elder law planning is so important. So we have an aging population in our country. There's a couple of reasons for that. Birth rates are lower with the younger population. And then as we age, we're also living longer than we have in the past because of advances in modern technology. And we'll talk about some of the problems that that creates as well. So the number of baby boomers that are out there, and you can see the years of that definition, is 73 million by 2030, which is only 7 years away, which sounds like a long, long time, but now we're creeping up on 6 years into the future, is all of them will be at least 65 years old. So in 6 years, every baby boomer will be at least 65 years old, and that's 73 million. And then by 2060, which most of us will still be working, 94.7 million people will be over the age of 65. One of the, I don't want to say downsides, but one of the effects of having a population that lives longer is they need more assistance because they're getting older. Some of these diseases that impact the older population and require more help as folks age require more services. And the classic and probably the most prominent one is Alzheimer's. So the Alzheimer's Association says by 2050, 12.7 million people will be living with Alzheimer's. So that's out of a population of 94.7 million. We're looking at 12.7 million of those will have Alzheimer's. And so who's taking care of these folks? And how can we help our clients plan for that? And so that's what we're talking about when we're saying Medicaid planning. And those services that we're providing with people as they age include estate planning, real estate transactions, financial protections, and then this Medicaid planning that we'll talk about as the webinar progresses here today. I do want to highlight in your materials, I have provided a page that has a number of different links on articles that I use pretty much every time I put together a presentation, and I want you to have access to those. One of those is an ABA article that came out a couple of years ago, and it talks about why elder law is a growing anything can happen practice. Elder law is kind of the overarching umbrella of services for clients that are getting older, that are in that 65 and older kind of that age bracket. And which is going to be growing, and you can see the numbers there. That kind of includes everything in elder law, and I think that goes back to that estate planning, real estate, financial protection with elder abuse, all those type of things. VA planning, special needs planning falls under there, and why anything can happen practice. It really is. I think that's a great article for folks to review. Some great elder law attorneys were interviewed for that, so you can get some insights from that article as well. So when we talk about Medicaid planning specifically within elder law, what we're talking about is long-term care. So what are we talking about when we're talking about long-term care? When I came over, and that's what a lot of what I was thinking about this morning when I was preparing for this presentation, were what were some of the things that I didn't know about this practice area when I started? And one of the things was I didn't really understand, and I didn't really understand how long-term care was kind of bracketed in services. Even though my family had, we had taken part in each one of these levels that I have listed on the screen, and even more levels of long-term care. So the first and most desirous type of long-term care is home health care. So this is a situation where you have a professional that comes into the home and help seniors with day-to-day activities. Medicinal services, and depending on needs, they'll provide all those services. So in my family, my father, he was diagnosed with ALS when he was younger, but we had a home health care nurse that came in every day. My mom went to work, we went to school, and the nurse was there to take care of my dad as the disease progressed. So this was the best. He had great insurance that helped pay for that. But you can see what the cost of that is in 2021. And unfortunately, these numbers only go up each year. The median cost of a home health care aide was $27 per hour. And services typically in that industry usually have to be purchased in 4-hour blocks, which result in minimum cost of $100 per day. You can do the math out with that. If it was 365, it would be $36,000 per year to have somebody come into the home at a minimum to help take care of a loved one. So that's the most desirous. That's what everyone wants, is to be able to stay at home, have somebody come into the house and help out. And so again, these are numbers that I put in here so that you can share these with other people in your community, with your referral sources, and with your potential clients to say, this is what we're talking about. This is why we have to put a number on things. We want to make sure that we're planning appropriately, so if something does happen, you can get the care that you want and not necessarily have to go on Medicaid as a payer of last resort. So kind of the next step on the spectrum of long-term care is assisted, well, first would be independent living, and then assisted living kind of falls after that. But these are those facilities where seniors actually live, so they move into a facility, but they're still active and independent, but they may need help with some activities. So my grandmother on my dad's side, she moved into an assisted independent living facility. And a lot of times you can move into one and then you'll progress through these different stages of care in the same facility. And that's what happened with her, is she started in the independent living wing. She had her own room. I think she could cook in there, but she was supervised. There were people coming by, making sure she was taken care of. She was, staying clean, taking her medication, doing any of the things that she needed help with. And then as she started, she had dementia. So as she started kind of going through that, the progress of that disease, then she moved into assisted living where there was more contact with the nurses. So that usually is not covered under any sort of government program. That usually has to be paid for by itself. There is a VA benefit that can help pay for assisted or independent living, but generally that needs to either be paid out of pocket or through some sort of long-term care insurance. So that's what we're talking about with that level of care. Now, the most intense level of care is that nursing home care. So this is facilities that offer around the clock care, and those are staffed by professional nurses and provide comprehensive care. So this is that classic, what you think of when the family's gone through the difficult process of trying to do everything on their own, but aren't able to make it work. So that's one where we have that situation where it's just really difficult. And this is where my mother's parents, fortunately, they kind of both fit into this category at the same time. So they were able to share a room, and there was a nurse always coming by. I think it was like once an hour, there's a nurse checking in on them, making sure they were okay. They had meals together in the same room. And this is the most expensive, but this is where most people at the end of their lives in America do need some sort of care to end up in some sort of nursing home care. And this is where Medicaid comes in. Medicaid pays for this level of care, where it doesn't really pay for those other levels of care right now. And we'll talk a little bit. I'll bring up some programs that are kind of getting funded, but not really, and they're very state to state, very specific on the state where you live of how robust that program is. So nursing home care is to provide assistance, and this is a term that if you're new to this type of planning, you'll want to write down: activities of daily living. And those have specific definitions, and they become really important when you get into some of the long-term care insurance programs, some of the VA programs. But I'll list them out as I wrote them down. Those include bathing or showering, dressing, getting in and out of bed, walking, toileting, and eating. So that's usually what nursing home care facilities are there to help out with, and not so much to that extent assisted and independent living facilities. So for me, I never really understood how those were broken out until I went to a seminar. So I wanted to break those out for you there. So who are the people that need long-term care? And I mentioned earlier, the majority of people will need some sort of long-term care. And this is the number that you should cite, you should memorize this number. You will use it a lot when you're talking to potential clients and referral sources, is 70% of adults age 65 or older will require some long-term care before they pass away. So that's 70% of adults age 65 or older will require long-term care at some point. That's a really important number to memorize. Just write it down three times so you know that number. In 2050, the number of Americans who require long-term care will more than double. So as I said, as we're getting older, the more people that are going to need this care is only going to increase. And then how long does someone need the care is really going to impact that financial, the financial burden that someone has to carry. So, and these, you can see where the references are for these if you need to put together your own presentation on this stuff. 2.8 years is the average projected length of a long-term care event, but remember that 20% will need care for more than 5 years. The Alzheimer's Association, they say that their average patient lives 4 to 8 years after a diagnosis, but some will live as long as 20 years. And at some point, their family's not going to be able to take care of them because they can't provide that around-the-clock care. And so they're going to have to find a resource for long-term care, and that's going to fall in at assisted living or the nursing home care based on what their needs are. So how much does this cost? And this is really where the numbers start getting staggering. It's about $8,000 per month. So think about what your mortgage is. Think about what your rent is for your office even. $8,000 a month is the median cost of nursing home in the US. And you can see there, that number comes from a 2021 Genworth Cost of Care survey. I have provided the link to that website. Genworth is an insurance provider, and they have this amazing tool on their website where you can even put in your zip code and find out what that cost of nursing home in your particular community is. It's lower usually in rural areas and much higher in the Northeast and then in more urban type areas. So you can really tweak that. And I would, if you're putting presentations together, I would definitely do that. And then I would go after the nursing homes and ask them, what's the median cost of care in a nursing home? And that's for a shared room. That's not even for a private room. A private room, I think, was closer to $9,500 a month. So another technique that we teach attorneys is calculate that out for a year and then contrast it with the cost of 1 year's tuition. Most families try to save up for college tuition. What families don't save up for is this cost of long-term care. And now we're getting into this 2022 KFF survey. So this is the Kaiser Family Foundation. They must have rebranded because they're calling themselves KFF now. But this survey came out along with the New York Times article last month. I think it was almost a month ago, the middle of November. And it has some really crazy stats in it. And I've just pulled out a couple of them. But again, I've provided that to you on those useful resources and materials so you can go in there and create your own presentations, create your own talking points to talk with potential clients and referral sources about. But these are the ones that I thought were just really impactful for our particular discussion of why people should get into this practice area. Is 66% of adults 50 or older feel anxious about affording the cost of a nursing home or assisted living facility, and then less than 50% of individuals over 65 have set aside any money to pay for long-term care. 70% of people are going to need it. Some people, the average stay is 2.8 years. It costs about $8,000 a month. That comes out to about $268,000. Where's that money coming from? Who's paying that $268,000? So in the US, the way that breaks down is private insurance is about 8%, and this is long-term care insurance. The best way to plan ahead is insure for it. Because long-term care insurance allows you, like I mentioned earlier, to you can use those insurance policies generally to pay for assisted living, for independent living, for nursing home, and you can pick where you want to stay. Not every nursing home accepts Medicaid dollars, and nursing homes would much rather accept private insurance money or your own money out of your pocket because they can charge you more. They don't have contracts with Medicaid to limit how much they're charging. So the best thing to do is help your clients Get a long-term care insurance policy in place. The earlier, the better. And the more comprehensive, the better. But that costs a lot of money. So private insurance makes about 8%. We'd like to make that a lot more. And if you need a long-term care insurance or a long-term care insurance broker, we do provide that here at Kraus Financial as well. Another 20% are just paying out of pocket. So they're pulling about $300,000 out of their pocket. They're paying for that. They're probably getting really good care, and they're bringing, you know, nurses in the home as long as that works. Then if they need to go into a facility, they're paying for it. They have enough money to do that. That's that 1% of America that can afford to do that. Then we have other public. So there are some other public programs that can pay for some long-term care. Medicare will pay for a rehab visit to a long-term care facility so long as the patient is showing improvement, and it's generally limited to the most 90 days, so 3 months, and then they need to get out of there, start paying for it themselves. There is a VA aid and attendance benefit that will help pay for the cost of assisted living. The rules on that changed in 2018. I think there's still a lot of great opportunity there to help people plan for that served in the armed forces, that they can get a benefit to be able to help pay for some of that. But you do have to do some planning. That kind of falls now more into the proactive planning bucket rather than the crisis planning bucket since 2018. And then there's other public programs that could cover a portion of the bill under specific circumstances. And these are what is referred to as home and community-based services or waiver programs. And these vary state to state. They're extremely underfunded. When President Biden ran for president during his presidential campaign, he promised a lot of money to home and community-based services. A lot of people in this industry were very happy. As it worked through the sausage-making process there in Washington, D.C., that got cut. But just on Tuesday, the administration came out with some charts and some stats on how they are trying to fund that, and they just announced $37 billion has been funded since 2021. And what the idea behind the home and community-based services programs would be is, let's not just help people that are in nursing homes, let's try to get some caregivers working in the home, getting paid a good wage, so that people will be able to stay in their home longer, and we can get them qualified for Medicaid without having to go to a nursing home. That obviously it's going to be very expensive, and we looked at all the numbers. So take a look at that report if that's something you're interested in. I did include that in the materials as well. Again, that just came out this week, so it does bring a little light. It shows that that priority is still there. Obviously, we're coming up on another election, so I'm sure that had nothing to do with that, but take a look at that, and you can see what they're doing with the home and community-based services. Otherwise, it's Medicaid. So Medicaid offers financial relief from the cost of long-term care, and we're talking about nursing home Medicaid, but applicants must meet strict requirements to qualify, and that's what we're going to talk about now, is the Medicaid program and who gets that help to pay for long-term care. So I spent a lot of time on the front end because I want you guys to get that information and be able to have those speaking points with your referral sources and potential clients. So Medicaid is a federal and state-funded program. It's a federal program that's then ran by each state, and it's meant for those with limited means. And applicants have to have specific criteria to qualify, both financial and non-financial. And then those rules vary state by state. So what works where I'm at in Colorado doesn't necessarily work in Utah, doesn't necessarily work in Florida. So you have to know your state rules and what works for Medicaid planning to help your clients get qualified to get help paying that nursing home bill each and every month. So the non-financial requirements generally aren't a big issue. Usually it's just be a US citizen or qualified, non-citizen be 65 or older, blind or disabled, and then the person has to reside in a Medicaid-approved facility, like I mentioned earlier. Not all facilities receive Medicaid funds. So the financial requirements, this is the hard part. This is the part that gets lawyers tripped up, and we're just gonna do, like I mentioned earlier, a real high-level overview of these, and we have a lot of resources in Attorney Access. So join Attorney Access on our website. That's our platform, our education platform. And we have deep dives into all these concepts. So what I want to do today is just really introduce you to these concepts, so you have, what, you know, as they say, enough to be dangerous, but you have some exposure to it, and then you can decide if this is something you want to take a deeper dive into. One thing that I missed when someone first taught me Medicaid planning was that we need to divide financial requirements into two separate boxes, income and assets. And income has its own specific rules. Assets have their have a whole different set of rules. So deciding which side one item belongs to will help you figure out under what rule set are we looking at. So one tip and pointer that an attorney taught me when I was first getting started is take your yellow pad of paper, draw a line down the middle, look at your client's finances and figure out, is this an income stream, an income source, or is this qualified as a countable asset? And you can see there at the bottom, something cannot be considered both income and asset. Generally, there's obviously exclusions to every rule, but that's just an easy rule to help remember, what are we talking about when we're talking about financial requirements in Medicaid planning? So let's talk about the institutionalized person. That's the person that's living in the nursing home, their income. To qualify for Medicaid, the institutionalized person income from all earned and unearned sources must be less than the private pay rate in the facility. We looked at the national average was around $8,000. So their income has to be less than $8,000. Generally not a problem. If we're seeing clients whose income is above that, they'll probably just want a private pay for their care wherever they want to stay. But generally when we're dealing with elder law, we're talking about pension, retirement funds, social security, things like that. That's their income, and it has to be less than the private pay rate of the facility. In some states, if their income exceeds a certain amount, and in 2023, that amount was $2,742, you have to create what's called a qualified income trust, which may be required. And the only purpose of that qualified income trust is to pass through any income that exceeds the 2742 number that then gets paid to the nursing home. And that's that last bullet point. And this is really the key takeaway from this slide, is the institutionalized person income minus a few allowable deductions becomes their Medicaid copay to the nursing home. This was a light bulb moment when I was learning this, is the person who's in the nursing home, their income minus a few deductions is going to the nursing home. So they are paying as much as they can to stay in that nursing home from their income minus a few deductions, and we'll talk about those. So what is that Medicaid copay? That's the portion of the institutionalized individual income that's going to the medical provider, generally the nursing home, once they're approved for benefits. And that copay is calculating where we take the individual's total income and we take out certain deductions. One of those deductions is called a personal needs allowance. That's an amount of money that varies state to state, from $35, I think is the lowest one, and then the highest one I think is in the hundreds of dollars, like $150. And that's just to pay for personal needs. Candy bars, haircuts, magazines, just personal needs. It's not much, and that's all they're left with. That's all they have. They can pay their insurance premiums, make sure that they're paying those to keep their insurance up. And then the other one is an income shift under the monthly maintenance needs allowance rules. And we're not going to go deep into those, but basically what those say is that if somebody needs, if the spouse at home needs some money, we can take some of the money that would be going to the nursing home and we can leave that for the spouse at home so they can pay their bills and they don't go impoverished. So if we have a married couple and we have the spouse at home, what kind of income can they have? There's no limits on the income of the community spouse. And this is a key component to crisis planning that we'll talk about a little bit down the road here, is that income at home has no limitation for the community spouse. However, if their income is low, and we talked about this on the last slide, below a certain amount, known as the monthly maintenance needs allowance, they're entitled to a portion of the institutionalized spouse's income. So that's taking away from what the institutionalized spouse is paying to the nursing home. Again, we're leaving it for the community spouse so that they can pay their bills. And that's called a monthly maintenance needs allowance. As you get into Medicaid planning, you'll learn all sorts of fun acronyms. This one's called MIMNA, as you'll hear that used across the country. Sorry, I'm just gonna take a break to have a drink. okay. that's community spouse income. So that's income. Those are the basics of the income rules. Obviously, there's a lot more to those, but that's just an understanding. The takeaway from those that I think are most important is the institutionalized person, they're going to pay most of their income to the nursing home, minus personal needs allowance, minus any insurance premiums, or if the community spouse doesn't have much money, we're going to leave some of that money for the community spouse. We're thinking about the community spouse, which is the spouse that's not in the nursing home. They can have unlimited amount of income. We don't want to impoverish them. They can have as much income. They can have an unlimited amount of income and stay in the community. Okay, now we're going to go to the other side of the paper. We're going to talk about assets. This is your client's stuff. The institutionalized individual is allowed to keep $2,000 of countable assets in most states. Connecticut, I know, is below $2,000. And then Illinois and New York, and there might be some other states, are above $2,000. But for the majority of states, it's $2,000. If you're listening to this webinar and you live in California and you're thinking about the Medi-Cal program, they have completely removed, as of, or what will be, January 1st of 2024, they have removed the asset limit altogether. It's $130,000 right now. In 2023, and in 2024, there's no longer going to be an asset limit in California. I talked to a California practitioner on a webinar that's on our website, so take a look at that if you're in California, and she talks about what she thinks is going to happen with this. California's always been an outlier, but now it's way, way out there as far as assets go. But all other states have an asset limit for the institutionalized individual of about 2,000, and again, there's a couple states that are higher, one state that's lower for sure, but most states are at $2,000. For the institutionalized individual, the person in the nursing home, so they can basically have no money, they have to be impoverished. And then we have the community spouse. So again, this is the spouse that's living in the community, they're allowed to keep a separate allowance, and that's called the community spouse resource allowance. So this is the stuff that the spouse at home can keep. And we'll refer to that as the CSRA, Community Spouse Resource Allowance. Again, lots and lots of acronyms if you get into Medicaid planning. So what the heck is a Community Spouse Resource Allowance? This is the amount of countable assets the community spouse may keep. Each state has a different number, but the CSRA for 2023 falls between $29,724 and $148,620. That's the range where that community spouse allowance is going to fall. And each state, again, calculates this differently. And one thing that I didn't mention earlier is all these numbers change every year. They generally go up recently. Since I've been doing this, they've gone up because the rate of inflation and just it's become more expensive to live in the United States these days. So these numbers tend to go up with CPI. So in 2024, they've released the new numbers. The adjusted increase is 3.7% from the numbers that are on your screen. And once 2024, once the calendar flips, when you go to the attorney access pages on Kraus, once the states announce their new numbers, we will have those on there. It's usually about halfway through January, towards the end of January, when all the states get us their numbers, and then we'll update the numbers on attorney access. So another great reason to use attorney access off our website. But if your clients have, the community spouse has more than the community spouse resource allowance, those assets must be spent down before the institutionalized spouse can qualify for benefits. So let's just do, again, we're doing real simple examples here just to kind of expose you to some of these concepts. If we're in a state where the CSRA is $148,620, and the community spouse's total assets are $130,000. And one thing I didn't mention is Medicaid, when you're counting these countable resources, doesn't care who's on the title. It doesn't matter if it's owned by the community spouse or the institutionalized spouse, they're gonna lump all those assets together and just count them as one unit. So since the couple's total assets are $130,000, that'll be below the CSRA, and then the institutionalized spouse is eligible for benefits. We don't have to do any Medicaid planning there. They're already able to qualify. They fill out the application. the community spouse gets to keep those resources, and then the institutionalized spouse then qualifies for Medicaid. However, if we have a community spouse resource allowance of that $148,620, and we have total assets of $200,000, excuse me, the couple has to spend down their excess assets before the institutionalized spouse can qualify for benefits. So we have to figure out what to do with those resources that are above the CSRA. But before we figure out what to do with those, let's talk about what's a countable and non-countable resource. So some assets are counted, others are not. The exempt assets that do not count towards the resource allowance is the primary residence. And that's always the most important one, obviously. So long as the applicant has an intent to return home, the primary residence is generally not counted. There can be a home equity limit on that home. If the person is generally a single person, there can be a home equity limit on that. And in 2024, that amount will be $713,000 as a minimum, or a maximum of over $1 million. So the home equity limit could apply. Generally, the couple can have one vehicle that's exempt. Other exempt assets are personal property, so you don't have to do an inventory of the home. Life insurance policies with face value of $1,500 or less, and then funeral expense trust, generally with a face value of $10,000 or less. And some of those specific numbers do vary state to state. But what else is counted? Basically everything else. And the way that I like to think about this is anything that the person can cash in, get some money, and go pay for their own nursing home care, Medicaid's going to count it. So that's checking, savings, and other bank accounts, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, deferred annuities, additional property and vehicles like ATVs, boats, RVs, things like that. And then in most states, your IRA retirement accounts will be countable. Some states have decided to exclude those and make those exempt. And again, that's a real state-specific decision, and you can get that information off the attorney access page for your state. So if we have our assets are above the community spouse resource allowance or the individual resource allowance, you have to do something with those assets so the person can get qualified. They can't just simply give away assets in order to reduce their countable assets. Medicaid has said, no, that's not allowed. That's referred to as a divestment, and that usually includes giving away assets for no compensation or selling assets for less than fair market value. But one thing to remember, and like I said earlier, the couple's assets are generally considered one unit. So you can make unlimited transfers between spouses prior to the initial Medicaid eligibility. And that's another strategy that we're going to use. So we have this thing also called a look back period. So the state agency will look back over the previous 60 months. That's the 5-year rule that you've probably heard of, from the time of the Medicaid application to see if the applicant has made any gifts. Basically, this is the time that Medicaid has their right to look in your client's business, see if they've been giving anything away in the last 5 years. If they have, they're going to penalize them. And that's going to subject them to a period of Medicaid ineligibility. And the way that you figure out how long the period of Medicaid ineligibility is determined by the amount of assets that were given away and within the look-back period. And that's called the divestment penalty divisor, or the penalty divisor. And that penalty divisor varies state to state. And again, that's a number you can get off the attorney access page for your state. It's supposed to represent the cost of 1 month stay in a nursing home to be able to figure out what the penalty would be if your client gives away assets. So we have an example of this where we have Bob, who has $200,000 in countable assets, but he needs to qualify for Medicaid immediately. So Bob gives away $198,000 to his son. He now has $2,000. So he's down to that individual resource amount. However, the penalty divisor in Bob's state is $10,000. So we're going to take the $198,000 amount and then divide that by 10. We get something less than 20. Sorry about the math there. I've never been said to be good at math. Excuse me. And he would be eligible. He would be ineligible for Medicaid benefits for whatever that number comes out to be. So we're helping Bob minimize the penalty period and preserve his assets. And what we're doing with crisis planning is we're preserving as much of his assets as we possibly can. Okay, let's move into crisis planning. What are we talking about when we're talking about crisis planning? The goal in crisis planning is provide relief to the client who's facing an immediate nursing home stay but hasn't done any planning. This is usually you have somebody, usually an adult child, comes to your office. They just put their parent into a nursing home. They got that first $8,000 bill. They said, "Holy cow, we're going to run out of money. What can we do?" Then they came to your office. And so what we're trying to do with crisis planning is accelerate the eligibility for Medicaid while preserving as many of the person in the nursing home's assets as possible, either for the community spouse or the next generation. Nobody saved up a nest egg to spend it all at a nursing home that I know of. So who is a typical client here? Is you have somebody who's already residing in a nursing home or about to go into one, has assets in excess of the resource limitations. We just looked at those are very low. Single person is 2,000, so that's most people. And they've exhausted or is not entitled to any sort of Medicare or doesn't have any long-term care insurance benefits. So they're looking to privately pay for their care at a clip of around $8,000 a month. So what we want to do is spend down assets so we can get this person qualified as soon as possible. But we don't want to spend all their money down to 2,000. We want, again, the goal is to leave something behind so that they can then leave a legacy without having to spend all their money at the nursing home. So we'll hear this term a lot, spending down assets. There's a lot of ways to do this. You can always purchase things for fair market value. So one thing that some folks will do is they will purchase or improve exempt assets. So let's say the house needs a new roof, or the person needs a better wheelchair. You can always buy stuff. So you can always buy exempt assets like improvements to the primary residence or personal effects. You can always pay off debts, mortgage, credit card debt, or other liabilities. We can purchase a funeral expense trust, or our favorite here at Kraus Financial is purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity. So the funeral expense trust is an exempt asset in most states up to $15,000. And these are irrevocable trusts that are funded for the cost of the funeral. And you can also use these funds and set them aside for burial reserves for things like burial spaces, headstones, mausoleums, urns. When someone passes away, we want them to have some money to be able to pay for the funeral and however they want to be buried or cremated. Okay, so that's an exempt transfer. Another one is a Medicaid compliant annuity. And this is a specific type of annuity called a single premium immediate annuity, also referred to as a SPIA. A Medicaid compliant annuity can be referred to as an MCA. And these are annuities with specific limitations on them pursuant to the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. In 2005, the rules for Medicaid planning really tightened up. And so you'll hear a lot of people refer to that as the DRA. And what we're doing with a Medicaid compliant annuity is we're taking those excess countable assets that were over the individual resource amount or the CSRA, and we're converting them into an income stream. And that Medicaid compliant annuity, because it has all these limitations on it, has no cash value. So when that is properly structured, it accelerates Medicaid eligibility while being able to protect some of your clients' assets. So what are the requirements of a Medicaid compliant annuity? Again, this is not something you're just going to go buy off the shelf. This is something that was specifically designed to be Medicaid compliant, and that's where Kraus Financial comes in. This is what the Kraus Financial and Dale Kraus has been doing for 30 years, is he created these Medicaid compliant annuities, and this is what they have to have in them and what the limitations are so that they comply with the DRA. They have to be irrevocable. So the payment amount determined, the parties cannot be altered. They have to be non-assignable. This isn't something you can sell on the secondary market. They have to be actuarially sound, which means that the term of the annuity must be fixed and equal to or less than the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. And each state has different tables that they use, but we also have those available to you on our attorney access page. The payments out of the annuity have to be equal. And then the state does have to be listed as a beneficiary to the Medicaid compliant annuity. It typically must be named the primary beneficiary on behalf of the Medicaid recipient, although some exceptions do exist to that rule. So those particular requirements are what make transfers to a Medicaid compliant annuity exempt transfer. So you're not getting penalized for taking an asset that's above, you know, liquid dollars above the resource allowances and turning them into an income stream. So the way that they're funded is either with non-qualified funds. So usually if you want to fund a Medicaid compliant annuity and they're non-qualified funds, funds outside of any sort of retirement account, generally you liquidate whatever it is, you get a check, and then you accompany it with the application to the Medicaid compliant annuity. Here at Kraus, we turn that around, generally around within 5 business days. We get that asset converted to an income stream, and then we go apply for Medicaid as quickly as we can because we know our clients are burning through $8,000 a month of their savings. If you have tax qualified funds and those are countable resources in your state, there's two options for funding a Medicaid compliant annuity. Is you can either do a trustee to trustee transfer or a 60-day rollover. And this allows the client to fund a Medicaid compliant annuity with their IRA and avoid those immediate tax consequences of having to pay for a large liquidation all at once. So either we can use this with non-qualified funds or tax qualified funds to convert an asset above the resource limits and create an income stream to be able to get folks qualified for Medicaid right away. So how does this work for a married couple? This is the simplest example that we have. Any countable asset exceeding the CSRA can be funded into a Medicaid compliant annuity that's owned by the community spouse. Because we remember that really important rule that we highlighted is a community spouse can have an unlimited amount of income. And then after purchasing the Medicaid compliant annuity, the couple's assets are eliminated for Medicaid purposes above the resource limitation. And then the institutionalized spouse can immediately apply and qualify for benefits. We took those assets above the CSRA off the table. We purchased a Medicaid compliant annuity with those. That money is going to come back as an income stream to the community spouse. Strategy for the single person is a little bit more complicated. We're not going to get into a lot of depths on this right now. But again, we do have resources for you on the attorney access page and some case studies as well. So you can really take a deep dive into these. But rather than fund the entire spend down amount into the Medicaid compliant annuity, we're going to gift away some of that money. And usually the client gifts that away to you know, a loved one or a trust of some sort. And then they're going to use the divestment rules to their advantage by usually about 50% of their assets are going to go in that gift. And then we're going to force a penalty period and the remaining assets are then used to purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity that's going to pay through the penalty period. So what we've done is we've taken any of the assets above $2,000 generally, about half of it's going to go as a gift. The other half's going to use to purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity. We've done that within the last 60 month look back period or 5 years. We're going to get a penalty for that. So we won't be able to qualify for Medicaid benefits that would help pay for the nursing home. That's what the Medicaid compliant annuity is going to do, is it's going to help pay through the penalty period. Once the penalty period is over, the Medicaid compliant annuity has been exhausted, and now that person can receive Medicaid benefits while their loved ones receive the gift. So that's really the strategy for a single person, and the economic benefit lies in the divestment or the gift, which is typically a wealth transfer to a trust or their heirs. There's a quick example of this here. We have John and Linda of the married couple strategy, or a married couple. Linda can no longer care for John. He must enter into a nursing home that costs $8,000 a month. They have countable assets that are preventing John from qualifying for Medicaid. His income's $1,800. Total countable assets are at $300,000. Linda has $1,100, and we know John's paying $8,000 a month to stay in the nursing home. With the cost of care being $8,000 a month, if they just didn't do anything, didn't come to your office, didn't see an elder law attorney, they're going to run out of money in about 43 months. But in this case, what we could do is we could transfer any money over the, let's see, what was it here? So we have a single premium annuity of $203,000. So we're going to transfer $203,000 to an annuity that Linda owns. She's the community spouse. And that term will be 36 months because that's less than her life expectancy pursuant to the Medicaid tables. And that is going to result in an income payment back to Linda of $5,645. So she's receiving that payment for 36 months. And that total payout is going to be $203,220 because there's a little bit of interest on there. Linda's the owner and payee. So for 36 months, she's going to receive $5,645 on that annuity. The primary beneficiary is the state Medicaid agency of the state where they live to the extent of benefits paid out on behalf of John. And then the secondary beneficiary would be their children. But so long as Linda lives 36 months, she's going to receive that total payout of $203,220. John's going to go on Medicaid immediately. He's going to pay his full income as his share of cost. And then Medicaid's going to pick up the rest of that $8,000 bill while Linda's receiving a monthly payout until that full annuity has come back to her for the amount that was above the CSRA amount. So again, that's a very simple example. We have lots of examples and more resources if you want to take a deeper dive into that on our website. So that's crisis planning. Again, the goal is to take assets that are above the resource limitations, turn them into resource or income streams so that folks can qualify right away for Medicaid benefits. So that's crisis planning, and that is generally referred to as the house is on fire, we got to put out a fire. What if we put in sprinklers and we have an insurance policy to help pay for all of this? And that's what's called proactive planning. This is much more akin to estate planning, where we're helping clients protect assets before a health crisis strikes. My check marks don't line up there. We educate clients and their families to make better financial care choices in the future. And we're going to have these conversations with our clients now in the event significant care is needed down the road. This is a conversation. This is clients are picking where they're receiving their care, who they want to give them that care, and how are they going to pay for that care. And we want to do this at least 5 years prior to having to apply for any sort of Medicaid benefits, if that's where they decide they want to go, is rely on Medicaid for their care, so that we don't have to disclose any of that because all those transfers were made prior to the look-back period. So generally, we want to protect as many assets as possible. And the tool that we're going to use in Medicaid proactive planning is an irrevocable trust that's designed solely for the purpose of protecting assets in the event of a future nursing home stay. And this irrevocable trust is allowed under the federal statutes. And I will point you, once I pull it up, to the federal statute. It's 42. USC 1396P. And the key to this for Medicaid planning is that irrevocable trust has to restrict access, sorry, and control to the principle of the trust under all circumstances. And that's, again, under federal regulations. If this trust is properly drafted and funded, the assets in that irrevocable trust are no longer considered countable assets of either the couple or the person applying for Medicaid, because we're transferring the assets to the trustee of this irrevocable trust. Then we're waiting 5 years prior to making a Medicaid application. Because we've waited the 5 years, those transfers were outside of the look-back period. No penalty will be assessed for that divestment because it's outside of the penalty period. So Those assets are no longer countable assets. We don't have to deal with those anymore because they're owned by the trustee of the irrevocable trust. We'll leave everything else out. We might retitle it to a revocable trust that the client decides, but everything else, as much as we can preserve, we're going to put in the irrevocable trust so that they're no longer countable resources for Medicaid planning. But again, you want to do that 5 years prior to making an application. We also want to couple that with long-term care insurance. So we'll talk to the clients about transferring these assets. Then we'll also say, let's get a long-term care insurance policy in place, because then the client can control where they receive their care. Remember, we talked about earlier that if you have a long-term care insurance policy in place, that's considered private funds. And if you have that in place, you can get care wherever you want to get the care. If you want to get it at the nicest nursing home, assisted living facility in your community, where all your clients' friends are living, let's get them in there. They might not accept Medicaid, so let's get some insurance that's going to pay for that, or we privately pay for that. So there's lots of different options for policy types and coverage. Long-term care insurance, the long-term care insurance industry has grown and changed and expanded, and so lots of different policy types now. The only restrictions with this is the client has to be in good enough health qualify for a plan. Then they have to decide the length and design of the policy, and all that's going to impact its cost and care. So long-term care insurance is definitely the number one way to plan for these types of expenses, because it leaves the client in control of their care. So again, a quick example, and we have lots of examples again on our website, but let's just look at a quick one. We have Sally, who's 68 years old in good health, lives here in Denver. She expresses she owns the family home. It's important that she keeps it in the family. And she wants to leave some money to her three children, Aaron, Amy, and Elisa. One thing to know when you're doing this type of planning is you really want to understand what your client's income is each month and how comfortable they are. So she gets $5,000 a month, and she's able to live off of that comfortably and travel as much as she likes to do. She has a house that's valued at $950,000, a checking account at $10,000, savings account of $100,000, and an investment account of $200,000. So we want to figure out, the one thing that we don't know in this fact pattern is, where's that income coming from? We're just going to assume that it's coming from another source that's not one of her resources. So we'll talk with Sally. We'll still do the classic estate planning that we want to do, make sure that all of her powers of attorney, her living will is in place. We'll create a revocable trust to avoid probate. We'll transfer assets there. And then the step that we'll do that not most estate planners would do is we'll create this specially designed irrevocable trust, and then couple that with some long-term care insurance so that she doesn't have to worry about what happens if she needs long-term care in the future. So we talk to Sally, we decide with her that moving the home into an irrevocable trust is what she wants to do. But what we're going to do within that trust document is we're going to say, Sally always has the right to live in that house. No one can ever kick her out. Just because the trustee owns that house, she still has a right of occupancy in the language of that trust. And then the investment account to leave some money for her kids, that's the liquid funds. We'll transfer that over to the irrevocable trust trustee. That money's off the table. Should Sally run out of insurance, let's say she gasses all her insurance benefits and she does have to go on Medicaid in the future, those assets would never be countable. Those are preserved. We know those assets are saved. So the home is going to transfer to her children, keep it in the family, and she left some liquid assets for her kids there. So we accomplished her goals and took away the risk that she would ever have to pay that $8,000 a month out of her pocket or take it away from her kids. Our work isn't done there. We do have to prepare and review the deeds transferring the property. We want to make sure that we're providing assistance so that we're transferring Sally's name off those accounts so that we can get the clock running on the 5 year. On the 5 year look back period. We want to advise Sally about the different long-term care insurance options available. We also want to stay in touch with Sally and keep in touch, because if new property or anything else is transferred into those trusts, then the 5 year clock starts again. So we want to continue to keep her on a maintenance program, have her come in regularly so that, let's say she does have to apply for Medicaid. We don't want her to apply for Medicaid for 4 years and 11 months into this plan, and now she gets a huge penalty because she didn't wait the full 5 years. So with Medicaid planning, a lot of proactive planning attorneys do have a really strong maintenance program, have the clients come in once a year at least, review any sort of transfers, make sure nothing's happened that would jeopardize that plan. Phew. All right, Katie, we covered a lot there. I'm sure we have lots of questions, and we have 1 minute, and I can't see them anymore. So you're going to have to feed me any questions that are there.
Okay, our first question, can you talk about the exceptions where the state is not the primary beneficiary to an MCA?
That's generally if there is a community spouse, a child under the age of 21, or a disabled child, they can generally be named ahead of the state with an MCA.
And the follow-up question is, can a 401k roll over to an MCA?
Yes, it can. And that would be with the trustee-to-trustee transfer or the 60-day rollover option. And that's something here at Kraus Financial we can walk you and your clients through very carefully, because we do so many of those each month.
Our next question, with the MCA, is the amount being paid to the nursing home during the penalty period the Medicaid rate or the private pay rate?
The private pay rate, because the Medicaid benefits haven't kicked in yet. So that'd be the private pay rate that you were paying to privately pay through that penalty period. then Medicaid kicks in, and then that's when that Medicaid pay rate comes to play. But Katie, let's talk about real quick before we take any other questions. I know we're at the top of the hour. If people do have to run, I want to make sure you get the attendance code. Is MPCLE23, and that'll be at the code at the end of the survey. Or if you need to jump off right away, Katie will email you that survey and you fill out that attendance code in that survey so we can get you that certificate of attendance here for the CLE here today. Any other questions, Katie, that we can do quick?
Yes. In some states, Medicaid does not cover assisted living communities. How does this affect planning?
Most states don't, unless you have a really strong home and community-based program. You want to work with your clients to figure out how they're going to pay for it. So having that conversation with them, like I mentioned earlier, the VA in attendance program can be an option for veterans, but that does require some proactive planning, or a long-term care insurance is really the best option there, unless they want to just privately pay for that if they have the wealth to be able to do that.
With us being short on time, that'll be the last question we answer live. But if you guys have any other questions, you can email them and I will make sure they will get to Jim.
Thank you, Katie, so much. And then we'll just go through a couple resources that we have available to you. If you saw this and you were like, that's disgusting, I want nothing to do with Medicaid planning, feel free to drop off. We got you the CLE credit that we promised you for that certificate of completion. But if this is something that you want to learn more about, and again, we touched this at a really high level here today, really quickly, we have lots and lots of resources. One of them that is a really great resource that is an industry standard is called the Kraus Report. Kraus Financial has been putting this out year after year. You can claim one at that website there, krausfinancial.com / Kraus Report. And that goes through all of these concepts in greater detail and in written format. If you're someone that learns by reading rather than listening, which I am as well, this Kraus Report taught me a lot of these concepts. So definitely grab a hold of one of those. We will be releasing the 2024 Kraus Report, again, probably at some point in January once we get all those numbers lined up and we can get that good information out now. But a lot of the general information is good evergreen quality content. So definitely get the Kraus Report. That's kind of a good first step to get some written information on this Medicaid planning stuff. Another hub that I've mentioned a couple times is Attorney Access. You can access that right off of our website. You can create a basic membership, which gets you a video series called Medicaid Basics that I recorded, and it goes in deeper and deeper on these concepts that we talked about, like the CSRA, the MIMNA concepts, a single person annuity concept, a married couple annuity concept. So get on there. It has a lot of resources on there for you, even with the free basic membership. If you want to take a deeper step with us, you can work with one of our business development advisors, very, very friendly. They've both been in the industry for a very long time. And we work directly with attorneys and staff to help you out. You're not on your own to do any of this. We're here to help you run the numbers, figure out what type of strategies might work for your clients. You can present that to the client. The client can either decide to move forward or not. And we don't charge you anything for that. That's 100% complimentary with no obligation to proceed. If you want to just chat with us, please feel free to take a look and have a discovery call with our team. We want to learn more about your practice, what you're looking at, what kind of resources we have to help you solve your problems, and how we can work best together. That's really what I love about Kraus Financial. Why I came here is it really is a collaborative effort between you, your clients, and Kraus Financial to figure out what the best solutions are for your clients. And let's help them guide them down the road so they don't end up broken when they pass away. We don't want anyone to die broke. And that's really what our goals here at Kraus Financial. So to take a deeper dive, have a chat with us. Again, no, it's not a high pressure sales situation or anything like that. Take a look at krausfinancial.com/discovery. I can't thank you enough. I'm very passionate about Medicaid planning. As you can tell, I could talk about this stuff for hours, but I will let you get on with your days. If you want to learn more, again, we have all those resources for you. Thank you, Katie, for getting the questions in. Thank everybody for attending. And please visit us at crossfinancial.com for more information. Have a wonderful holiday season, and hopefully adding Medicaid planning to your practice next year is part of the strategic decisions you're making here at the end of the year. So thank you, everybody, and have a wonderful day.